All right, the following is an interview with William Cross by Dixie Hips for the Kentucky Oral History Commission. Our project is Prohibition and its effects on Nelson County, Kentucky. The interview was conducted in Barrystown, Kentucky at 211 South 5th on 9/27/88. William, would you like to tell me when you were born and your parents and anything about yourself and your education and all?
I was born August the 25th, Dixie, 1913. My mother was Duncan, and she was originally from Nelson County. My dad was Thomas Cross from Breckenridge County. He met my mother in Louisville, and they married. And later on, well, they had a family. Mm-hmm. And my dad always said that he didn't like large cities, and he wanted to raise his family in a rural area. So my mother's home place was a farm like 34 to 36 acres. And when it was just three of us kids, well, my dad moved to Nelson County and purchased my mother's home place. So, okay, you asked me about my education. At that time, where I was raised was approximately a mile and a half from East Bardstown and about a mile from Early Times. And the school that I attended 1 through 8th grade was a one-room school at East Bardstown. And now, as you know, I was on the school board quite a while, and it was amazing to me how some people seemingly lived half a mile from school on their truant picked up, when for 8 years I walked a mile and a half to 2 miles every day, rain, snow, sleet, or what have you. And then after I finished the 8th grade, at the time I went to school and you graduated from the 8th grade, you had to take a county examination before you could go to high school. And the county superintendent conducted this examination, or a representative from his office. And of course, I was one of the lucky ones that passed the examination. And on the corner of First and Bashir, where it's a marker now, at that time it was a four-year high school for blacks. Mm-hmm. And the name of the school was Nelson County Training High School. And that's where I attended 4 years high school and graduated. And the rest of my education is through hard knocks and bumps and through practical education and experience.
Well, then, if you were born in 1913, then you were about 7 years old when Prohibition first came in 1920. Your father was a farmer, or was he a craftsman?
My father, yes, that was his love, was farming. But he lived in Louisville at the time. Of course, I don't know how many years, but his family moved there when he was, you know, still single. And he and his dad worked for Mangle Box Company. And then his dad got injured and died from injury. And he had several sisters and brothers still at home, so my dad didn't marry until all of his sisters and brothers were grown and out of high school. And then after that, well, he went to work for a company that bottled whiskey, not massive production, but back in those days, according to what he told me, well, that they bottled it, you know, in their place of business. They had a bottling operation in the basement. And they didn't just bottle whiskey, they bottled all kinds of wines and cordials. And I know you have heard about people, and I don't think they do it so much now, but they used to, doctors prescribe certain types of wine and liquors for your health, and my dad used to fill these orders and deliver them and all this before he purchased my mother's farm and came to Bardstown. And then after he came to Bardstown, Well, of course, he had to, or Nelson County, he had to find the job. And the farm that he originally purchased wasn't large enough to make a living on. So he, you know, did day work.
Mm-hmm.
And during Prohibition, I heard him say, see, at this time, I remember when the original distillery at Early Times was named Early Times. Brown Foreman, I believe, yep, owns the brand in Louisville now.
Right.
Well, that was originally Early Times. And I remember when it was a bottling operation. I remember all of it. I don't remember the distillery very plainly, but I remember different warehouses, the bottling department. And up over the bottling room, it was a post office.
Oh.
And it was a grocery store there. And at 6:30 in the morning, just strictly a passenger train stopped at Early Times going to Louisville. It came back at 11, at going to Springfield, and it came back by Early Times at 2 in the afternoon, and back at 6:30 in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And it was strictly a passenger train, and then they had a freight three days a week, mm-hmm, in addition to the passenger train. Anyway, well, they had trouble. At that time, instead of using cardboard cases, they used wooden cases, and they had put in a new nailing machine, and they couldn't get it to work. And I had an uncle who knew my dad had worked, you know, mm-hmm, in bottling operations, so he told them about my dad, and some of them came out there and got him, and he went up and looked at it, and he told him to go to the grocery store and get him a can of talcum powder. And they did, and he mixed his talcum powder with the nails and put in the machine, and it worked.
It worked.
From then on, see, then this was during Prohibition.
Ah.
And then, well, certain days or whenever necessary, they would bottle whiskey, even doing Prohibition, for medicinal purposes. So whenever they bottled, well, they would let my dad know, and he would always go up and run the nailing machine.
That's neat. So he was connected with Early Times then. During Prohibition, Nancy McKay was talking about Early Times and, mm-hmm, her memories, and she kept saying, I know they were bottling, but I don't know why, because she remembered the bottling,
yeah,
but she said, I know that was during Prohibition.
Yeah.
So they were bottling medicinal.
Yeah, that's right.
Then as you were growing up, of course, did you walk up the distillery with your father, or you just knew what was going on there?
Well, see, the post office was at Dixie. You didn't have rural mail carriers like they have now, and everybody in a certain area, that's where you went to get the mail. And the owner of Early Times was named Mr. John Shawnee.
Mm-hmm.
And his wife was Jack Thorpe's auntie.
Right.
Great auntie.
Right.
Yeah. And he knew that, you know, my dad, and I have one brother 2 years older than I. When we came up here from Louisville, it was just the three of us, mm-hmm, my oldest brother, Martha, and I.
Uh-huh.
And I was always small. I didn't grow until after I got out of high school. And anyway, well, Mr. Shawnee used to tease me a lot when I'd go to the post office. They had company offices in the same, you know, on the second floor. And seemingly to me, the people that worked in the company office would give you your mail too.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to kid me all the time. I remember that very distinctly.
That way. Well, then after they bottled the medicinal whiskey, did they finally shut down, or do you remember if they?
Well, they, as I indicated, they just bottled certain times, and what happened to the rest, the balance of the whiskey was on hand. I wouldn't have any idea, really. You know, I don't recall ever hearing anybody mention it.
Well, Mr. Shawnee, did he die during this time, or did he live?
Yes, he died. I'd say, yeah, he died during Prohibition. I remember he remodeled the house. Who lives in there? Dr. Anderson?
Yes, uh-huh. Right, on North 3rd Street.
Yes, I remember he did extensively remodeling on that house. And the way I recall, he didn't live too long after that. But at that time, I would say that was the most elegant house in Barstown.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yes.
They're working a lot on it now. I think they're going to put a lot of that back or try to uncover a lot of that. Of course, distilleries, there were at least 12 distilleries operating when Prohibition came in Nelson County. And we, some of the questions that we were trying to find answers to, we assumed the economy was affected badly because everybody was put out of work. Even if it was part-time work, like you're saying on that one distillery, they could only work part-time. Do you know of anybody that, any jobs that some of those distillery workers went to, or did they move away, or did they have another factory start up or anything like that?
To my knowledge, they didn't move away. They didn't any factories start up. They just, you know, farmed and did the best they could. Of course, I feel sure that some few left, but I say the majority of them stayed in surrounding area. Yeah. Until things got better.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, this is right before in the 20s, and then you had the stock market crash, 29, and then depression all through the 30s. So I don't know whether we had a depression here starting in the 20s or whether we just had 15 years or so of hard times and as far as the distilling industry didn't. Do you think that, what do you think about the bootleggers or the moonshiners? There were some of those around.
I would just like to say that I'm not a prohibitionist, but I don't, you know, I did taste moonshine once to see what it actually tastes like, and I didn't like it. Yes, I think personally that prohibition was really bad for the country, not just from the economy standpoint, but prior to prohibition, well, the government collected billions of dollars a year taxes, which was used to benefit the country as a whole, poor and all. And during the prohibition era, well, instead of them collecting billions of dollars to help the government and the economy, they spent billions of dollars trying to enforce prohibition, which they never was successful.
Right.
And the saddest part of it all, the way I see it, Dixie, is that was the loss of lives. It was so many lives lost. Even though you were a legal prohibition officer and you go out to raid these fields, you just liable to be shot down. Mm-hmm. Just think of the families that's left behind. And also the moonshiners. I would be afraid to even guesstimate how many people lost their lives during the prohibition era.
Yeah.
And they never did stop it. I mean, in other words, if they would, I mean, I'm a deacon of my church and I do not, you know, believe in overindulgence, but if they would, you know, offer a bill today to vote whiskey out, I wouldn't vote for it because I have a real bad memory about what happened before. And I think it would be the same today.
Same today.
That's right.
Well, it seems like anything we prohibit makes it more attractive to people.
Yeah, that's right.
That you just can't stop them. It seems like when you say, no, you can't do this, that it's a challenge instead
right.
of a deterrent. Yeah.
Makes them more determined to do it.
Well, we had, I know there are a lot of families that were connected with the distilleries, and when some of them changed jobs, some of them just kind of waited it out. Of course, some of them got rich in various ways. They talk about how this one seems to be very prosperous, and they don't know why. He didn't have a job that seemed to bring him much money. But the politicians, did the politicians kind of turn the other way when the bootleggers were going through? Or
Of course, you know, I couldn't say in the affirmative that they did, but it was a lot of rumors that they did. And back to your question, when you mentioned some people got rich, Well, on government whiskey that was stored in warehouses, well, the people that worked in these warehouses, I'm told, had connections with the owner and management, and they would steal this whiskey out and put so much water in barrels, and then they'd have this legal whiskey to sell, and they could get almost any price they would ask for it. So that's what happened to a lot of illegal whiskey.
Well, there are a lot of stories told, and this this interview isn't like testimony in a court case. Oral history is really hearsay, you know, because we just pass along what we've heard, and kind of, some of it is personal experience, but just like your father talking about his things, and you know, he's not here to tell us, so we have to use, you know, your memory to remind us. One of the things that, too, we've been talking about, the social life, a lot of people... Of course, now you go to wedding receptions or parties or any get-together, and there's usually alcohol served. And the different ones I've talked to seem to think that they never did this before Prohibition, that men went to a bar and got a drink, but they didn't bring it home. And I don't know if you have any feeling about that or not. It seems like
I wouldn't have any idea about that because my mother didn't even drink soft drinks, and my mother and dad, either one, you know, drank the alcohol, so we didn't have it. Well, in other words, when I was a kid, I saw bottles in the closet, maybe two or three or something, but to see them drink or anything, well, I just never did see them do it. And, you know, of course, they didn't go to bars, and I was a kid, so I don't have any recollection about that.
You mentioned about the medicinal purposes. Do you think doctors did prescribe it for different things?
According to what I was told, I was told that
I knew
what
that
they did.
Legally,
you would get a prescription, and you could go to the drugstore and get liquor. Yeah.
You think any of the doctors sold prescriptions for people who weren't really sick?
I would imagine.
That makes sense, doesn't it?
I would think so, but of course I don't know that.
No, you don't have any of those prescriptions, yeah.
No.
Was there any conversation about big city crime or big city people coming in and buying whiskey, or
yes, especially during the moonshine. Well, that was during Prohibition. Yes, big city moonshiners came right into Barstown, and I never did see the operation, but I knew people that they say were, you know, big bootleggers. They would come. They would have local people here who had connections, and they would give them an order, just say for 50 gallons of moonshine. And the customer from Louisville and other places would come here. They would have apartments and pick it up. They tell me that they hid it under the floors in their homes. And I know I have remodeled a house, and I found a hole in the floor. And my worker and I, that's what we figured, because this house, this guy used to bootleg.
Right.
So, and I know I heard about him being raided, so, and I don't recall him ever being caught, so I'm pretty sure I found where
he had
it. He had
a hiding hole,
in the floor, you know, and carpet over it. Well, you couldn't tell the difference, but in remodeling the home, of course, he was dead and gone, and that hadn't been so many years ago, but I bet that was where he was at.
Where
he's
keeping it, right. Well, there are a lot of, I know in our travels here, they tell us there are a lot of fortunes in Barstown that were made during Prohibition that they're still using. That way families had just, one of the ancestors just decided that he's going to ignore the law and make money while he could.
Well, when I was working at JTS Brown, well, the second month after I was there, I was warehouse superintendent, and of course we took entry in it. During that period, you cut barrels, and when I say cutting barrels, well, you would weigh the empty barrel in prior to filling it, and you would put the tear on it, And then after you fill that barrel, it would go back on the scales and you would get the gross weight.
Right.
And the net weight would determine the wine in proof gallons in mm-hmm. that barrel. And I'm the guy that did this. You
took care of that.
And of course, it was like your multiplication table. You could study them and learn them by heart. And, you know, it's just like singing a song. So that's what I did. I memorized them, you know, in a certain area, like from 350 pounds up to 375 pounds. So anything in that range, well, I didn't even have to look at the chart to know the gallon.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, a certain person who I would name, you know, real, real well, he used to come, he hauled slop for J.P.S. Brown. And he would come, if you couldn't get slop until a certain time mm-hmm. after it started to bury still and all that. And we took entry the first thing in the morning. And he, I think he liked me.
Mm-hmm.
And he would come over in the sister room, and not only he would be talking to me, but my helpers and the governor's man too, to hear everything he's saying. And he would tell about how he, you know, how moonshine. And like he said, sometimes he'd have so much in the attic and different places, smell so plain, that when he had company, he would take this, you know, this Dr. Hess dip, disinfectant or something you use on the farm to dip sheep in. He said he'd mix that up and spray around all the outside around his house to keep it from keep the moonshine from smelling.
Ooh,
so
from giving away.
He could tell us some real,
oh.
And he ended up in real good shape.
Real good shape.
Yeah.
Ingenuity there. You know, there's a lot of pitfalls there in running moonshine and this whiskey and stuff I may never thought about. I hadn't thought about the odor being so strong. Of course it would.
If you have a lot of it, it smells.
What do they have put it in jars or in kegs?
They had it in kegs, gallon jugs, they tell me fruit jars.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing, we were talking about the loss of life.
Uh-huh.
Some people were careless in distilling moonshine, and you know, it would have a poisonous effect.
Mm-hmm.
And according to what I heard, well, quite a few people died from drinking inferior quality of moonshine too.
But then it would have been better then to have consumed the government whiskey they took out of the warehouses.
Right.
Because it had been distilled under certain conditions, they knew it was good.
That's true.
That way, so. Dublin whiskey's better than illicit whiskey.
It's
so.
It's pure and
yeah.
Then you derive a benefit from it too.
When we look at the records, about 1990,
they list all of the different barrels they've taken out of the distillery and into bottle. You know, they have what they call warehouse receipts.
Right.
And
they had that after prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way they did. Like, for instance, when we were making whiskey, say, for instance, you want to buy so many barrels of fall production, spring production, so forth,
mm-hmm.
and you wanted to store it in our warehouses, well, they would issue you warehouse receipts, you know,
mm-hmm.
listing the serial number of the barrels, the wine and proof gallons and date and all that stuff. Something like CD.
Mm-hmm. Right. That it was put in there and then it stayed until it matured.
Yes, right.
Yes, your CD. Okay. I wonder what we could call it. Whiskey withdrawal. Okay. A WD there. The did you ever get do you ever hear them talk about how they felt like it was going to be repealed and they just had to wait it out, or was there ever any conversation there?
Yes, I remember hearing them talk about it, and some said it would and some said
it wouldn't,
and eventually it was. Yeah, it was talk about it several years, I'd say, before it actually happened.
Anyway, there was some talk, one of the interviews we had, we talked about a canning factory in Bardstown, that they only lasted maybe a year or two, but they thought it might have been set up to help employment, maybe the latter part of the 1920s.
I remember a can factory, but as you say, it wasn't very long.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't last very long.
Do you think the tourism helped locally? You know, in 1922 is when the Montucky home was purchased, and they started showing it to the public in 23. And do you think tourism had any effect on the area since, you know, the distilling was down, or do you remember any of that?
I suppose it had some effect, but you didn't hear about tourism anything
mm-hmm.
like you do now.
Yeah.
I
mm-hmm.
think it was a minor attraction.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, we didn't have many places to stay.
That's
and places to eat
yeah.
either,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. like that. That way. I know that your sister became a school teacher, and you were saying that after Prohibition, you went into the distilling industry at JTS Brown.
Right.
And you mentioned it was the first or second startup.
I won't say it was the
okay.
second, but
I
think Bart's, in other words, I say it would be among,
okay.
If I recall correctly, well, Bartstown Distillery was the first that started.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember, but we started in 35. I know that.
Started production in 35.
Yeah, started production. That's what I'm talking
mm-hmm.
about.
Did they have to do a lot of repairs on the distilleries?
During my sister.
Right. Well, I was thinking about, you got into the distilling mm-hmm. business later, and that's where some of these stories. And then I thought about Martha teaching. Did she go into teaching out of college?
Yeah.
Or?
Yes, she did. In other words, when we finished high school,
mm-hmm.
If you graduated from high school and passed the county examination,
mm-hmm.
you could teach through the eighth grade.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, she didn't do that. She went to college, but she didn't do teaching before she graduated from college.
Mm-hmm.
And then after she graduated, well, she continued her education and got her master's degree from Indiana U. She graduated from Kentucky State,
mm-hmm.
you know. Then she did some additional work, and then my second sister was a teacher. She got her master's from, well, she worked on the Columbia University,
mm.
and what's the university in Cleveland? I can't think.
Not Kent.
No,
that's Ohio. Okay.
I know about it. Anyway, that's where she
mm-hmm.
got her master's. Then my third sister was a teacher also.
Mm-hmm.
All of them was teaching but the baby sister.
Okay.
And she did about 3 years college, and when she got married, well, she and her husband moved to Frankfort, and they bought a grocery store, and she operated the grocery store until their youngest finished college. And
oh,
when
wow.
the youngest finished college, she retired. Had been retired ever since, but she just the people in her neighborhood love her because she just does charity work.
Okay.
If you have a pain, call Edna. Well, she's there.
Takes care of it.
She was a citizen of the year in South Frankfort about 2 years ago.
Wonderful. That's a really. I'm sure that your father and mother are looking down very proud about all of you all.
I've tasted. I never did
make any homebrew. Well,
I tell you what I have made, Dixie. When I was at home as a teenager, I made grape wine.
Grape wine, uh-huh.
A domestic grape and wild grape, and also corn cob wine. Wine out of corn cobs.
What is it in corn cobs that would ferment? I never have understood how to make
it. I don't know, but the way I did it, someone told me.
Yeah.
Well, after my mother had canned corn,
uh-huh.
well, I took the cobs and put in a stone jar.
Okay, the green
and
corn.
Just
yeah.
barely covered them over with water, and then at that time I knew how much sugar, and I put sugar to it, and it fermented, and it really was potent, too, I'm telling you.
I guess there's still enough sugar in that carbohydrate. You
in
know,
the
cob. In the cob,
yeah.
but...
You know, I always thought when they talked about corn cob wine, I was thinking about the cobs that you have after you shell corn.
You mean dry corn.
Yeah, and I couldn't figure out how in the world.
It's a
it's
green,
the green corn.
Yeah.
All right, now that's cleared that
and
up.
And if it's made right, it has a real good taste, but it's really strong.
Well, some of these, like some of these things coming out, this homebrew they talk about, I assume it's a type of beer.
It tastes something like, you know, malt beer.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember during my high school days, well, a lot of people made homebrew. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they had it around the home, and then a lot of people sold it. Yeah.
Did they put it in bottles and sell it? Or
yeah.
They sell it
yeah, they had they put it in bottles. I have a capper somewhere if I can find it that they tell me that's what it was used for, capping homebrew. But I know it, I would say it's some capper for some, you know, bottle like a soft drink.
You know,
bottle.
I can see you. Now we go around picking up the cans for the money. I bet little boys got paid something for picking up the bottles then, did they?
I don't recall that.
Somebody, because, you know, there couldn't have been too many bottles.
That's
if you want them all brought back.
That's right.
Yeah, that way. But what about, I know the sheriff, we talked a little with some of the others about Wallace Brown, who was the judge, county judge, and he was a teetotaler and was, you know, probably was unbribable. I mean, I always had the opinion he was very upright. But you had sheriff and you had the federal officials, and of course you had the jailer, or Mr. McKay was jailer, I think, during most of that time. And I heard the phrase buying a road, that you could buy a road, and that was the road the moonshiners would use because they knew that nobody would be patrolling it and things. Was there, of course, a lot of talk about it, I'm sure, on who was bribable and who wasn't. But did you ever have a feeling that there was a lot more of that payoffs and things like that going on? Or?
Yes, I do have that feeling because, you know, I've heard people say that a lot, and they had people, Dixie, they called them in those days pimps. And you know, say for instance, just ordinary citizen, you know, you don't like, you can ride around through town now on a holiday or Sunday afternoon and you can pretty well tell where something illegal is going on.
Right.
Well, that was true during those days.
Mm-hmm.
And say, for instance, a guy knew who bootlegged, and he scouted through the country woods and things, and he'd run up on moonshine, and these moonshiners would pay this guy to keep quiet. And as long as they paid him, well, he would, but if they quit paying
him,
well, for some reason, well, the revenue officers would soon be raised.
Be right there.
And I know one person that was a noted pimp, and I remember one time back in those days, it was used to have tent shows.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, right across from REA building, all that was a vacant lot. And also along there were the senior citizens.
And that was a big field.
Yeah. Well, I remember seeing this guy one night, and they tell me that it was people looking for him. Of course, I didn't know it that night.
Yeah.
I was at some tent show there, and they said if they had found him, they were going to kill him because they had been paying him off. And, you know, he had turned them in. And I think he did get caught, beat up maybe a couple times and almost killed and all that. But
looks like he would be, somebody else could have turned them in and they'd never know it, but they'd assume this guy did because he said he knew all about and threatened, huh?
Yeah.
That's when your mouth got you in trouble.
That's true.
Yeah. That way. Did anybody, somebody's been trying to tell me, and of course they don't mention any names, that there was a pretty prominent man in town who was going to get caught. He had a still or a bootlegging or something anyway, and someone else took the blame for him and went to prison. And while he was in prison, the first man supported the prisoner's family while he was gone. Do you think anything like that might have happened or could have happened? Or
I would think it was possible.
Yeah.
Because it was the big guys usually got out of it and somebody under them took the fall.
That's
so
the fall. Mm-hmm.
I imagine they paid dearly for it, but still that was a lot better than going to prison.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That way. Of course, we were in Wake County before Prohibition and Wake County after Prohibition. There were lots of dry counties around us. Do you think being a dry county actually helped the situation in terms of alcohol consumption, or did just making it harder to get cause more problems?
According to my thinking, I believe the dry county caused more problems. Yeah. It didn't keep it out. I'd say it was just as much moonshine in the dry county as it was in the wet county. And probably more expensive in the dry county, but it was there.
When your distillery started back up, Mr. J.T.S. Brown, was that all local money, or do you think that there was there any investment from out of town? Or?
Well, I was pretty close to Mr. Brown. It was supposedly owned by Mr. Brown, Creel Brown Union, and
mm-hmm.
his wife. And personally, I think they did own
they did
it.
Own
but
it.
I mean, I would,
mm-hmm.
you know, I.
Well, we were discussing earlier about money, you know, that it took some outside money because all the distilleries had to have so much work done to them. They'd been sitting there 10 years at least.
Well, I feel confident they had to get additional money somewhere before, I don't know, but I doubt very much of taking someone else in as partner. And I know whatever they decided to do, when we first started bottling, we started bottling whiskey when it was 2.5 years old.
Mm.
And of course, you know, they planned it to where when it was 2.5 years old, we had the bottle in the dump room, facilities, filtering operation, all that ready to go. And of course, we were small, and you know, the entire operation was small, but it was a complete operation.
Mm-hmm.
And when we first started bottling, Mr. and Mrs. Brown ran the bottling room.
Oh, I love it.
And
yes.
I lived down South 3rd Street, me and my family. And after I left work in the afternoon, Mr. Brown also was his own salesman. You know, all distilleries, I'd say, have salesmen, even back in those days.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't have a salesman. He was his own salesman. He'd go to Lexington, Louisville, Chicago, Little Rock, Arkansas, wherever we had accounts. Well, ever so often, he would go there and service those accounts himself.
Uh-huh.
And if something came up after I had left the distillery, maybe as late as 9 o'clock at night, Mr. and Ms. Brown have come to my house with a worksheet of how many cases of quarts, fills, pints, half pints, and so forth need to be bottled the next day, and who they were to be shipped to and all that. And when I'd get to work the next morning, they'd be gone, and then I would run the bottling room until they got back.
Got back, yeah. That was
the... I did. Mr. Brown could do anything that was to be done in a distillery. Well, now, he couldn't repair anything, but he could do anything from firing the barrel to running the beer still.
Yeah.
And making the whiskey. He's the one that taught me the distilling, you know, actually how to make the whiskey. See, the last 8 years we distilled at Early Times, well, I didn't distill it.
Silly.
After he got, well, I'd say, see, he sold the distillery back maybe like in the 40s, I believe, the first time, and he did real, real well on it.
Mm-hmm.
And after then, of course, he had his parents' home in Anchorage, and it was huge, and he always had a desire to move back to Anchorage.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1941, he came to me and talked to me about at that time, I was strictly in charge of the warehouse and dumping and mm-hmm. bottling, you know, when necessary, I was mm-hmm. in charge of bottling. And he wanted me to take over the distillery. Well, they had some men in the distillery that was hard to get along with. And the people I worked with, well, it was just like one big family.
Family.
Yeah, we just got along fine. When I had to run the bottling room, well, I never did have but one lady that I believe would say that didn't really like me.
Mm-hmm.
And today, if I meet a lot of times, some of them will holler at me and I haven't even seen them.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, well, I wouldn't take it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next year, the time to start the plane, well, he was down sick in bed and he sent for me. And I went to his bedroom and he talked to me for about 3 hours. And he talked me into, he offered me a bonus at the end of the year. And then at the middle of the year, if we had a good year, he'd give me another one. And
mm-hmm.
of course, I would get more time. And then
yeah.
at that time, I was strictly working by the hour.
Mm-hmm.
And then a chance of getting on straight time and
mm-hmm.
all this. So I took it. In the
mm-hmm.
last 8 years, well, really, I was in charge. He went to Florida. He might have come back one time during the winter,
yeah.
you know, but.
Well, that, I was going to ask you about the making whiskey. During the war, did you make any alcohol for the government?
Yes, we did.
Uh-huh. How did that work?
What we did, Dixie, you know, to make the finished alcohol, you have to put in a special column.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of distilleries didn't do this. They made what they call high wine. And then it was shipped to the plant that had the alcohol
oh.
column,
mm-hmm.
and it was, you know, finished there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, really, they call what we made alcohol, but really it was high wine. It had to be redistilled.
Right.
Yeah, during the war, I, well, that was when I first, in other words, when I took the plane over, well, I moved out of early times.
Mm-hmm.
They furnished me a house and telephone.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it was a big farm there.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave me milk. And
right.
they were they
sounds
were good. And but during the war, well, I worked all hours because we had storage tanks. And of course, everybody was making high wines or
mm-hmm.
alcohol in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Patch Fitzgibbon. You ever hear of Patch Fitzgibbon? He was a trucker. He had big tank trucks. He lived over where Woodrow Hahn's wife lived at one time.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I remember him living there. And anyway, well, different ones. Roger Carter's, I believe, company had the trailer trucks, you know,
mm-hmm.
They called them pups. And like, for instance, they were coming to your plant, your tanks were all full. Well, they would come to, say, maybe my plant and drop a pup beyond, you weighed it, and that's the way you figured your gallon,
mm-hmm.
and then they'd come to your plant. And the guard has come to my house like 1:30 or 2:30 in the morning and knock on my door and say, the alcohol truck's there, and I'd get up and go up there and load the truck. And on top of that, though, what made it so inconvenient, see, the government had the keys to everything.
Oh, yeah.
And I would have to call the government man mm-hmm. here in town, wait for him to get up and dress and drive out
mm-hmm.
the early time. And then he would have to figure the gallons, and so would I for the company.
Mm.
And a lot of weeks back to back, I worked over 100 hours a week.
Oh my!
And now, if a guy works hour overtime, he thinks it's murder.
He thinks yeah, it should be paid double, right?
That's right, and he thinks he's going to die.
Did you have any problem getting help during the war for the distilleries? Is that a problem?
It was a problem, and what J.T.S. Brown did, they ran a school for the other distilleries.
Oh.
That's what, see, we were small, as I indicated
uh-huh.
earlier, so we didn't pay as much as Tom Moore, Heaven Hill, and
Fairfield
or whatever. T.W. Samuels and wherever, Fairfield there at the railroad. They would come to J.T.S. Brown, and I would teach them wherever they start working. They learn there, and as soon as they learn how to do something, they go to Plain where they could make more money, which I don't blame them, but it was really hard on me. I went to Mr. Brown several times, pleaded with him for a raise for my health, because I told him, I said, all in the world I'm doing is just running the school for the rest of the distilleries.
That's right. That's right. We're hoping to get Thompson on an interview. We haven't gotten him down yet.
What he did, he offered me a job. You know, he didn't persuade. I remember I said, well, he asked me what I was making, and I told him, and he said, well, we'd like for you to work for us. And I said, well, they furnished me a house, and telephone, milk. And he said, we can furnish you a house, telephone, and milk, too. I remember,
he's gonna meet all of them.
I remember him telling me that.
Oh, my. Well, I know a lot of things going on here. You know, people, it seems like a lot of people stay in Bardstown. They either grow up here or they come here and get the roots down pretty deep and stay.
Yes, quite a few people come here and retire.
Retire.
That's right.
And we must have, of course, there were people, new names that came in after Prohibition was over that invested in the distilleries. And of course, there are a lot of names no longer here. But I know the Heaven Hill, their owners, that's when they started their distillery up, was after Prohibition. And then Mr. Samuels, of course, he was a distiller here before, but I understood he had to bring in some money to try to get his thing going again. You can't leave any factory still for 13 years and it not deteriorate.
That's true, yeah.
Did any of them sell the equipment out of the distilleries? Was there any market for that?
I don't know, but at early times, as I indicated in the beginning, the only thing left there was one warehouse. One big storage house. And the rest of the plant and the distillery bottling department all was done away with. Now, what happened to the equipment and all that, I imagine they got some sales for it.
Well, I know it, when you wait around 13 years, a long time to wait to start back up that way. Did they have did the distilleries have cattle operations at most of them, or feeding operations and the slop and things, or?
You mean after Prohibition?
Well, before or after?
Before, I would know. But since Prohibition, a lot in this area they did. I know J.T.S. Brown, and that was a profitable operation. You know, Mr. Paget used to sell the slop down here at Tom Moore. And, of course, I'm told that's where he got his start. And I know at J.T.S. Brown, well, of course, Mr. Brown, he wasn't a Jew, but I would pit him against any Jew when it came to making money. That's true.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sincere. I learned a lot from him.
He was thinking all the angles.
To managing and like that. And he fed cattle, and then he also sold, you know, he had certain customers he sold slop to. So he was making it on both ends.
Both ends, Well, if you can, if you make money off of your waste, and that's basically what slop was.
Sure, that's right.
Then you can wait that out, because those years you're waiting for that whiskey to age and you sell it, you got to do something there too.
That's right.
The cattle. Trying to think about now. Did they have a separate farm set up? I mean, the manager of the farm, or they just fed the cattle and took care of them?
They had. That was a separate operation. Now, how they handled it book-wise, I don't know.
Well,
I would say it was probably record-wise, too, but they had the distillery crew where I worked. We didn't have nothing to do
with
the cattle
and
all that.
The government people, during Prohibition, they didn't have to be anybody at the distillery when you were bottling, or when you were bottling medicinal whiskey, was there a government agent or storekeeper gauge or anything?
I couldn't answer that.
Remember
I remember them bottling, but I never did.
Never
was asked that before, and really never did think about.
Well,
but after Prohibition, the government carried the keys to everything. Mm-hmm. Now, if you were bottoming out of bond, mm-hmm. you had your keys, but even when you were bottoming in bond, well, you couldn't get in your wholesale liquor dealer's room or your bottling department, your dumping department, nothing. You had to get the government man to unlock to let you in. Even though you'd paid the tax, you
yeah,
know, all
already,
and everything.
Yeah.
When we first started bottling Dixie, the tax on whiskey, the federal tax, I believe, was $2.25 a gallon. And I don't know what it is today.
$12.50.
Okay, during the Korean War, I remember they put an extra $2 and something on it, and they said they were going to, it was just for the
duration
of the Korean War. But I knew then they'd never take it off.
Yep.
And I mean, I don't know how many times that, to get the stamps, then you put a stamp on each barrel, and you had a stencil,
mm-hmm.
and you canceled
mm-hmm.
the stamp, and you to get this stamp, to pay for these stamps, you would have to get a certified check.
Oh.
And locally, you could pick these stamps up over the post office where the library is now,
uh-huh.
and the federal people had an office upstairs.
Right.
And you take all your paperwork and your certified check and get the stamps upstairs.
Mm.
And then you go back and tack the stamp on your barrel and shellac over it and then cancel it. And then roll it down to your dump room and cut it right off.
Oh, my God. I mean, like within an hour or something, huh?
Well, you do it. It was a continuous
operation.
If you was in a hurry for your whiskey. Yeah, you put it on the warehouse, shellac over it, cancel it, and go roll it right down and haul it right down to your dump room and take the stamp off.
Well, at least they had their certified check. They knew that wasn't going
to
bounce.
Yes, that's right. You'd
yeah.
have to have a
certified
check.
Mm.
Farmers, we did business. Farmers Bank was right there where Lucky is
right.
now. So that was handy.
Just went right across the street.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. I've been taking antihistamine. Mm-hmm. That's why. The weather. Well, William, I have enjoyed this trip back into early distilling and medium distilling. And there's a lot of things about it I don't think most people know. And then all the different efforts. Something did come to mind while ago when we were talking about you doing all of the distilling or all the process. Doesn't each distillery have their own strain of yeast? Do they grow their own yeast? Or how does that work? How did J.T.S. Brown do it then?
I can't answer that. When I first started doing distilling, well, we had copper jugs, what they call, and in those jugs, what they call juggies.
Mm-hmm.
There was already some yeast
in
there.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I did, when this yeast got fairly old,
uh-huh.
or when my production began to fall back,
mm-hmm.
well, I would make me a new starter,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, and go from there. And from this jug yeast, well, you made what you call a donny, and you would activate it with the jug yeast, and then this donny would be a starter in your mash that
mm-hmm.
you had in your yeast tub. This donny started it fermenting, and then the yeast in your yeast tub started your big fermenter out in the fermenter room
mm-hmm.
ferment. Now, that's the way we
did.
Now, all I know about, you know, distilling is
what
the way J.T.S. Brown did.
Right. Well, you started out, though, with a strain of yeast that you just kept continuing, though. Basically,
yeah,
you kept it from that yeast jug and kind of
reactivated
it.
That's right.
Yeah.
If my production dropped down, well, or I didn't wait for it to drop. I mean,
you kind of knew how long it took. Yeah,
ever so often I would make me a new star. And I would give what was left to the guys when they get off from work. It would make it was potent.
Yeah.
It would make you drunk right now. I remember one of the guys that worked in the warehouse, he came by then. He lived across the field, not too far. And I told him, I said, he never had drank any before. I said, Hobbs, I said, be careful now, don't drink. I said, I'm going to pour it out.
Yeah.
I don't mind what you drink, but it'll make you intoxicate if you're not careful. And he, when he came to work the next day, I was surprised. He told me what time he got home. Yeah, he said that he got about halfway home and he just, you know, he said just threw him and he didn't have any idea the stuff could be.
That's
that
right.
Potent.
So he got tight on the juggies.
Juggies.
Right. Okay.
See, when I made a new batch of what was left, I would just pour it out.
Yeah.
And it had a, I like the taste of juggies, what we made, better than I do beer. I don't like the taste of beer, and I didn't like juggies that well, but I could.
It had more to it, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you, William, for all your memories there. I think this is about the end of our tape.
Well, you said